TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Christopher Hitchens, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, Part 1.
Well, in Harper's Magazine this month, there's an article called The Case Against Henry Kissinger. Explain, Christopher.
I think he's a war criminal. I think he's a liar. I think he's responsible for kidnapping, for murder.
Christopher Hitchens, in a clip from the 2002 documentary, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, a film based on Hitchens' research. The case against Henry Kissinger appeared in the February and March 2001 issues of Harper's Magazine. Later that year, Christopher Hitchens released an expanded version in his book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Hitchens' publisher Verso summed it up. Weighing the evidence with judicial care, Hitchens investigates Kissinger's involvement in the war in Indochina, mass murder in Bangladesh, planned assassinations in Santiago, Nicosia, and Washington, D.C., and genocide in East Timor, drawing on first-hand testimony, previously unpublished documentation, and material released under the Freedom of Information Act. Hitchens mounts a devastating indictment of a man whose actions resulted in both individual murders and widespread indiscriminate slaughter. End quote. Here's Seymour Hersh.
That this man could operate at such a horrible level and not get exposed for year after year after year after year, how many people came out against him? It's an embarrassment to my profession.
Another clip from the film, The Trials of Henry Kissinger. Christopher Hitchens died on December 15, 2011, age 62, and his work on Kissinger stands strong in spite of controversial positions he took later, such as his support of the invasion of Iraq. Hitchens was a columnist, editor, and investigative journalist. He wrote for The Nation, Vanity Fair, Harper's, The Times Literary Supplement, New York Newsday, and The Atlantic. In the fall of 2001, Christopher Hitchens came to San Francisco to talk about his just-released book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. I recorded him at Modern Times, an independent bookstore in San Francisco's Mission District. Christopher Hitchens spoke freely without notes. He did have a copy of the book, but pulled it out only once to refer to Kissinger's photo on the cover when the issue of Saving Face came up, and how much it may have cost to save that particular face and that of Kissinger's boss, Richard Nixon.
When Henry Kissinger was asked by General de Gaulle why he was continuing to bomb what had been French Indochina in what was evidently a futile war of aggression and atrocity, he replied it was a matter of saving face. Have another look. Imagine how many human lives would you sacrifice to save that face. The subject of my book is exactly those human sacrifices and how they were exacted, how they were lied about, and how they were justified, and how they still remain unpunished. And the best way to begin might be at the start, which is at the point at which Henry Kissinger made the transition from being a mediocre, time-serving academic to the one-man global rolling crime wave that has been his career ever since. Now, let me just ask you something. Have you ever heard the phrase peaceful, orderly, democratic transition of power? You have heard it. Have you heard it recently? I'm just trying to brush your patriotic G-spot, if I can find it. Okay, well, I see not in vain. One shouldn't have to keep on being told that there's a peaceful, orderly, democratic transition of power. If there really is a peaceful, orderly, democratic transition of power, it should go without saying, right? In 1968, there was a United States presidential election in progress, and there was also in progress the same war of atrocity and aggression in Vietnam. And by the mid-summer of 1968, it's fair to say, the majority of the American political establishment and probably a majority of the American people had concluded that at the very best, this war was a great mistake, and the shortest way out of it would be the best way. And even Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey had sponsored peace negotiations in Paris with all parties to the conflict, and that was the Democrats' re-election platform for that year, the peace plank. And Richard Nixon, with three other men, evolved the following plan. He decided that he would go to the South Vietnamese military junta secretly, and by the way, illegally, and make them the following proposition. If you withdraw from these talks in Paris, if you sabotage them by withdrawal, and if you do so in a timely fashion on the eve of the election, and if the Republican Party wins as a result of the collapse of the Democrats' re-election program, you'll get a better deal from the incoming administration. You won't hear all this talk about negotiations with Hanoi and halts to the bombing process and all of that. We won't inflict that upon you. It had to be done very carefully because it was extremely unlawful. And it used to be that this was a hypothesis in Washington, a conjecture, a theory. Some people would say a conspiracy theory. But it's no longer correct to call it that. It's now established as a matter of record that that's what those men did. We know it because President Johnson had Nixon's campaign plane bugged and his campaign headquarters bugged, and he recorded the treasonous transactions. And just last year, my friend Anthony Summers was able to get the FBI transcripts, and I have them in the book for your reading pleasure. The people who did that were Richard Nixon, John Mitchell, later Attorney General, and Spiro Agnew, later Vice President. And there was a fourth man, Henry Kissinger. And the rest you know, because once Nixon was in power, he, having met Kissinger only once, personally, once and not alone, to shake his hand and be introduced, immediately offered him the job of National Security Advisor. That was at their second meeting. And a problem at once presented itself. An illegal mortgage or lease has been taken out secretly for an extension of the war by 4 years, perhaps five. And this lease has to be paid off. And paid off it was. Of the 57,000 or so names that are incised in stone on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., 21,000 of the names were added after 1968. We don't want to know, and I suspect daren't ask, how many Indochinese civilians and combatants lost their lives in the same period. There's no wall big enough to write the names on anyway. And the war had to be extended in order for the illusion that it could be won to be kept up. It had to be extended into two neutral, peaceful, non-combatant countries, Cambodia and Laos, and the supervision of that war, which was also fought and conducted in secret and without the knowledge of Congress, because it must be said for all of you, ladies and gentlemen, at least, your government thought enough of you to lie to you throughout this period. Take that as a compliment, if you will. I think you're entitled to. They did not think you would support what they were doing if you knew what it was. It's something. It's something to cling to. But it's not much when you think of the mass slaughter round the clock in Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, and the loss of 21,000 illusioned young Americans, and the fact that the war is then ended very ignominiously indeed on terms less advantageous to all than were available in Paris in the fall of 1968. Let it sink in for a bit, because if you think of these two actions as one action, in other words, the deliberate sabotage of an American election, the undermining of an American election process by a covert action, and the extension of an illegal imperialist war for 4 to 5 years, and the infliction of perhaps an additional, I would say, 2 to 2.5 million casualties, it, I think, constitutes the single wickedest act in American history. I don't think anyone will nominate a rival to it for that title. And note this, too. Of the four men who committed the crime, Richard Nixon managed to avoid impeachment. The first article of impeachment, by the way, was for the secret and illegal bombing of Cambodia. It's a great pity that trial never took place. But he managed to avoid impeachment by copying a plea, as you'll all remember. Spiro Agnew, Vice President Agnew, was indicted for other reasons and retired in all kinds of disgrace. John Mitchell, who with Henry Kissinger sat on the 40 Committee, the only Attorney General ever to sit on the body that oversees covert actions, of which Kissinger remained the chair, became the first Attorney General to go to jail. Actually, we got one, just for once. the slammer, behind bars, for just one of them, for using the CIA and the FBI as a corrupt private political police to repress dissent and spread misinformation in the United States itself. So that's 3 out of 4. The lonely impunity of the fourth man strikes me even now as fantastically conspicuous, not to say nightmarish, the unindicted co-conspirator of the whole web of crime and aggression that starts in 68 and ends in Watergate. But on the subject of democratic, peaceful, orderly transitions of power, I have a number of others I'll mention. The first, and in a way the most noticeable one, was Chile. Now in Chile, one of our friendlier and more democratic and civilized neighbors to the south, the Chilean people took a real pride in the fact that alone in the southern cone of the Americas, they had peaceful, democratic, orderly transitions of power. You couldn't say the army was above politics in Chile. It wasn't. It was a very conservative army indeed, and it would intervene in things like labor disputes and so on between elections, but it very scrupulously abstained from picking governments. And the Chileans were very proud of this, and their neighbors in Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay and Paraguay and Ecuador and so on were rightly envious of them for it. And in 1970, there was an election in Chile, and it was won by Dr. Salvador Allende and the Unidad Popular, the Popular Unity Coalition. And Chile has a 60-day, I believe, but I might be open to correction, it may be a 90-day, at any rate, a minimum of a 60-day transition period between the election results being announced and they're being confirmed by the Supreme Court and the Parliament. In that period, it was decided at a meeting in Washington that there wasn't going to be a democratic, peaceful, orderly transition of power in Chile, that the party and the president that had won the election were not going to be allowed to assume the seals of office, and that the army would substitute for that. But a problem presented itself at once. The head of the Chilean armed forces was General René Schneider, an honorable conservative officer with a constitutional cast of mind who thought it was his job to ensure that the officer corps in Chile kept its oath only to uphold the Constitution and was not seduced into the breaking of that oath. To every problem, there is a solution. At the same meeting in Washington, it was decided that General Schneider should be murdered. The person convening the meeting was Henry Kissinger. I can show in this book, do show in this book, what lawyers in the Washington slang call a lay-down case. In other words, we have the minutes of the meeting where the scheme to murder Schneider was evolved, was concocted. We then have the discussions as to who is to be given the commission to execute this task, this hit. A group of extreme fascists, actually to give them their correct name, they were a bunch of men of proven records of extreme political violence, who'd actually tried to overthrow the Chilean Christian Democratic regime from the right a few years before. Fascists, in other words, were tasked with the job. Money was provided for them lavishly. We have the records of that now. Guns were sent to them through the American diplomatic pouch from Washington to the CIA station in Santiago. These men were told, keep it up. They made 1, 2, 3 attempts, failed. On the third attempt, with repeated injunctions to keep going, they killed General Schneider, shot him down in the street. They were then paid off again, a very large sum of money, paid after they'd committed the crime, and the evidence was destroyed and withheld from investigators in Washington, D.C., and in Santiago de Chile. It's a complete case. As of last October, when, thanks to Congressman Hinchey's amendment in Congress, we got the confirmation that the money had been paid after the hit, which means we don't need the C words any longer, collusion, complicity, collaboration, but the A words, accomplice, aiding and abetting, accessory. In other words, as guilty as if you pull the trigger yourself. And that was an individual murder committed by Henry Kissinger. That was, anyway, the curtain raiser for the complete abolition in Chile of the whole concept of the peaceful, orderly, democratic transition of power, and I won't have to weary many of you, I know, with what that led to 3 years later, and the murder not just of the leaders of the Chilean ruling party, elected ruling party, but the murder of democracy itself, the asphyxiation of democracy in Chile for nearly a generation. I've got some other transitions if you'd like. Would you like one more or two? Could you stand a couple more? Okay.
You're listening to Remembrance of Christopher Hitchens, speaking in the fall of 2001 at Modern Times Bookstore in San Francisco. His book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, had just been published by Verso Press.
The people of East Timor, if they can get any feeling back in their limbs at all as they recover from what they've been through in the last years, will sometime, with luck, have a peaceful, democratic, orderly transition of power and also to independence for their country. They were slated to have this election in 1975, when the Portuguese authorities gave up colonialism and announced as a UN trusteeship that they would supervise the transition of East Timor via an election to an independent state. It was decided by Henry Kissinger, sitting in the same room as the Indonesian General Staff, that that was not going to happen. There was to be no such transition, either to independence or to democracy. In the room with the generals, and President Ford also, he approved directly the Indonesian invasion of East Timor and the Indonesian attempt to extirpate the East Timorese people. And he made sure that the weapons of mass destruction required to conduct this operation were supplied to them. And again, I have all the minutes of the conversations, including a very damning one that he had at the State Department when he came back, because this involved a multiple breach of three sets of laws. First, by invading the territory of a neighboring state, which was in trusteeship to Portugal, a NATO ally, under the United Nations, Indonesia committed the grossest possible violation of international law. By deciding that East Timorese people were the obstacle to the consolidation of its design and setting itself to remove them physically from the scene, it violated the Genocide Convention. And this may seem trivial, but it also violated American law. The Foreign Assistance Act prohibits the use of American weapons for any purpose except external self-defense. And external self-defense does not consist of invading peaceful and defenseless neighbors who are in any case the responsibility of another country and the international community. In all these things, Henry Kissinger was completely, personally complicit throughout, in particular in the sale of weapons, at a time when he knew, and the Indonesian Foreign Minister Adam Malik confirmed very early on in the process, that just in the invasion of East Timor itself, just in the original takeover, the Indonesian Foreign Minister thought probably not less than 150,000 people had been butchered. And that was before the news became evident of the use of food denial, starvation, defoliation, rape, and other weapons of indiscriminate genocide. At all these points, Henry Kissinger made sure that Congress was deceived and the flow of weapons by which this atrocity was carried out was maintained. And then leaving office, as he did a short while after that, was rewarded with a half share in a large gold mine in Indonesia, and with a seat on a number of important corporate boards doing business in or originating in Jakarta, a role that he discharged until very recently, and in fact continues to discharge in the case of the Freeport-McMoRan gold mine, which is one of the many sources of his income, because another offensive thing about this character is that his second career involves the franchising of the idea of dictatorship. He will advise people on how to keep their dictatorships going. He will advise corporations on how to do business with them. And he has made a gigantic profit out of the contacts and friends that he made during his time in office. But let's again just mark something. Pinochet, Suharto, Papadopoulos and Ioannidis, those are the dictators in the military regime of Greece. These men are all either in jail or they're going there in their own countries. All of Kissinger's partners internationally, and it's trite to say partners in crime, are all on their way to the joint. Not before time, but not Henry. Though it's my privilege to be able to say to you that under the Alien Tort Claims Act, a very noble, ancient piece of American legislation, now that we do have all the evidence about the direct complicity of Kissinger and other officials in the murder, kidnap, torture, and disappearance of named identifiable Chileans, there are Chileans who are able to sue. Who are able to sue for the deaths, the wrongful deaths of their brothers and husbands and fathers and indeed in some cases their wives and mothers too. And they are going to sue. They are going to bring a civil suit, and they are going to sue Henry Kissinger. And I think it's about time. And you applaud, as you should, and it shows your comradely generosity, decency. But isn't that an absolute disgrace? Shouldn't everyone in this room be sick with shame that it's being left to the victims to volunteer, to scrape together the resources, to bring a suit in America when they've led lives completely maimed and tortured for 25 years and more, not even knowing where their loved ones were buried, that it's left to them to bring a civil prosecution? That is a national and cultural disgrace of a fantastically high order. And I want to make it as serious a point as I can. If there was one event that I would like to have been present at in the last few years, it would have been this. The British Special Branch, on a certain day, those lads were told, go round to where General Pinochet is, disconnect his phone, tell him he's under arrest, read him his rights, he's nicked. And they went round, and I'd love to have been there. Yeah. Put under house arrest where he was only able to receive visits from Margaret Thatcher, which, if not exactly cruel, certainly unusual, I'd say. Now, and this warrant executed on the order of, or on the request of a magistrate in Spain, remember, and taken to the House of Lords, which said that you may not any longer plead to charges of torture and murder and disappearance and kidnapping. You may no longer plead sovereign immunity. They struck down the defense of sovereign immunity. You may not, in other words, say, yes, I did kill these Chileans, but I was hoping to impress Richard Nixon. It just somehow won't work. It used to work. I think that the right way to think about this is as the test case for the new international situation that has been created by the arrest of Pinochet and by the arrest of Slobodan Milosevic. We do, as a matter of fact, now live in a world where universal jurisdiction is being adopted by the courts of many countries. In other words, the war criminal is the common enemy of humanity, like the pirate or the kidnapper. He's to be arrested wherever he may be found and either tried there or repatriated to where he's wanted. That's universal jurisdiction. It's beginning to apply. And there are lots of people who are worried about it. The second is that sovereign immunity is gone as a defense. The third consideration is that the United States remains the most voluble moral tutor and lecturer to the rest of the world on the necessity for the speedy capture, trial, imprisonment, and punishment of war criminals. This situation is too absurd to continue, really, any longer. And I don't believe it can continue. And even if it has to be left, contemptibly enough, to the efforts of Chilean volunteers and victims to bring it to a civil case in New York, it is inching closer. And as I was readying my book, I can't tell you how I came across it, but I stole a tape, and I've reprinted it for you, of Kissinger talking to his publisher. He could see a political crisis coming when it presented itself. And he's rattled, and he's taking advice from lawyers everywhere he travels now. And every time I think of that, I make a little holiday in my heart, and I invite you to join me. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Christopher Hitchens in a 2001 book talk for the release of The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Christopher Hitchens died on December 15, 2011, and this rebroadcast claims one of his most important works, in spite of the controversy around decisions he took later, such as his support of the war on Iraq. Hitchens' work on Kissinger may be his most enduring, in spite, or maybe even because, it is taking so much longer than expected to bring Kissinger to justice. At age 88, surviving his most passionate critic, Henry Kissinger is promoting yet another book, this time on China, to counterbalance his widely described role as a war criminal. However, his book tours are hampered by a now worldwide movement to arrest him. A Google search for the terms Henry Kissinger and arrest shows 2.9 million entries. Hitchens spoke about the attempts of the family of the murdered Chilean general René Schneider to hold Kissinger and CIA Director Helms responsible for his assassination. The case was argued in March 2005 in the United States Court of Appeals, District of Columbia Circuit. The court decided on June 28, 2005, that Kissinger and Helms were acting within the scope of federal employment, that Kissinger was immune under the Westfall Act, and that Schneider's assassination was a matter of, quote, foreign policy designed to prevent the spread of communism. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to review that decision. Hitchens also mentioned that after the Milosevic and Pinochet cases, universal jurisdiction is being adopted by the courts of many countries. Here's an update. Amnesty International announced that by November 2011, 85% of the 193 UN states have defined one or more of the core international crimes within their domestic law. That includes war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and torture. The Alien Tort Claims Act has been used so often in recent years that there are considerations by Congress to repeal it or to protect corporations from being sued under the Act. The Alien Tort Claims Act is an 18th century law allowing foreigners to bring lawsuits in U.S. courts against those who aid and abet international law violations committed against them. The Act has recently been used in cases ranging from charging Boeing in participating in rendition flights to suits of boards of investment for purchasing bonds invested in illegal activities abroad. You heard part one of a one-hour remembrance of Christopher Hitchens. Come back for the recording of a lively Q&A period at the book release party for The Trial of Henry Kissinger, an ongoing project with great opportunities for success that is Hitchens' legacy. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. For an audio CD of The Trial of Henry Kissinger, call anytime at 707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.